Do you want me just to answer questions specifically?
We can start with that.
Or I can just start rolling down the history.
I just have an introduction, and then we'll get on with some of the questions.
Okay.
Today is Friday, February 2nd, the year 2001. We're in Holt, Michigan, at the laboratory of Dr. Barnett Rosenberg. I'm Jeff Charnley, interviewing Dr. Rosenberg for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial to be commemorated in 2005. As you can see, Professor Rosenberg, we're taping this. You give us permission to record this interview.
I do indeed.
Okay. I'd like to start first with some questions about your general educational and professional background. Where were you born and raised, and where did you go to primary school?
Okay. I was born in New York City. I am a New Yorker by choice and have spent most of my life there. No, not most of my life by now. I think it's about 50-50. I went to school in the Abraham Lincoln High School in Brooklyn. I became interested in science early on. Before that, my friends and I were always tinkering around with different things, and we built an astronomical telescope, and my friend had a rather good chemistry set, and so we picked up some chemistry that way and interested in chemistry.
Was there any, did you have any clue as to what sparked that interest? Initially, was it a person, a teacher? you mentioned your friends.
Well, initially, it came about by virtue of reading the an encyclopedia that was on the market at the time, starting with the page one. And what I found in reading it was that the most interesting things to me were the articles that had to do with science. And I knew then, at a very early age, I'm talking now 6 and 7, that I was going to be a scientist. And this was going to be my role in life. Then the movies affected me, things like The Invisible Man. There was a scene, for example, of a wealthy man owning a large mansion and having in the back of the mansion a laboratory, and some two or three people working with him on a particular research project. And I was struck with that. And that sort of sat in the back of my mind for many, many years until finally I put it into action, as you can see. That's my house over there, which is only about 200 yards, I guess. So, very early on, I had a deep commitment to science. Now, which science, however, varied as my life progressed. I went to Lincoln High School, where science was a very significant part of the curriculum there. It was one of the best high schools in the country at the time. From there, I was affected by the war, of course. I went to Brooklyn College after I graduated from Lincoln High School.
What year did you graduate?
1944.
44, okay.
And then I went to Brooklyn College and majored in chemistry. After about a year and a half of studies, I reached the age of 18 and entered the Army. I spent 18 months in the Army overseas in the Philippine Islands. And there I met a fellow, a German scientist, who had left Germany because of Hitler. And he was giving a course in physics after the war ended, for the soldiers that remained on the island. And this is the Philippines. And I took the course, and I was fascinated by it. So I began to switch from my chemistry interests to physics. And I realized then that what interested me most about chemistry was physical chemistry. Mm-hmm. So the physics came easy to me. And I had a girlfriend at that time who was very much interested in physics as well. Mm-hmm. And she indeed eventually did get her PhD in physics and remained so. So at that time, after the my graduation in 1948, I went to Europe for a year and studied at the Swiss Polytechnic Institute in Switzerland.
So this was 1 year in Switzerland that you studied?
Right. It was just, for me, it was just a year to play. Uh-huh. And I enjoyed it enormously. Mm-hmm. I did take courses, mm-hmm. But unfortunately, I sat in on a course, or took a course, that was given by, I've got to start to lose names mm-hmm. very quickly soon.
We can add them.
The great theoretical physicist at the time. Anyway, he was a theoretical physicist, mm-hmm. and he started out with a set of equations that I had just finished just entering into in my undergraduate work. And he went on from there at a rapid rate, never looking at the people, always looking out the window. Mm. And eventually, the kids started to leave his class. It was just too hard. And I stayed there for about 7 weeks, I think. And then there were about five of us left. Mm. And I left at that particular point because it was wholly useless to me. Mm-hmm. So in any case, at that time, I came back to the United States. After a year, and started my serious studies at New York University's Department of Physics as a physics major. I did some interesting work, and I made some interesting discoveries, and got some patents that were interesting, too.
Or very early in your career.
Yeah, this was quite early.
What were they related to?
The solid-state physics. They were a new form of it was sort of like a magnet which you can demagnetize and remagnetize, mm-hmm. but this was an electrical charge. You could put a charge on something and have it permanently charged, mm-hmm. or you could discharge it. Mm-hmm. Well, it can't keep the charge. It separates two charges, so it's polarized. So you can have it either polarized or unpolarized, and it'll stay that way. Mm-hmm. So it's a way of making a new memory device. Yeah. So this was in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. So there was some interest in it in terms of a memory system for a computer. Mm-hmm. And I did some postgraduate year's work at the Computer Center at New York University, and to develop this thing. After a while, however, I became aware that solid-state physics was not that fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. Other things were far more so. And in fact, a lot of physicists who were involved in the atomic bomb research came to the same conclusion. Either perhaps guilt feelings or other things that opened up that were more fascinating, but a lot of them went into a new field called biophysics. Mm-hmm. And I started to look into this and indeed decided I was going to be not a pure physicist, but a biophysicist. And I took a job in the physics department at New York University with a government grant to do some biophysical work. And shortly thereafter, I started to look around for a permanent position. and met some people who were also interested in a permanent position. Three of us got together and decided we would try to set up a biophysics department at some university. And we looked around at a number of different places, had interesting offers from all of them. The only one that I regret turning down was Berkeley, because of the weather. We got the offer from Michigan State University. And the reason why the offer was made was because of John Hanna. John Hanna had the wisdom to believe that science was going to be important in the future world. And our university was deficient in that area, except for the agricultural part. So he then set up a committee of different scientists to search out for a biophysicist. Well, we met with them, and they were pleased with us and offered us the job, all three of us.
Who were the others?
One was Leroy Augenstein, who at the time was a true biophysicist Camp Upton on Long Island. There was a large science laboratory. I'm blocking on the name of it. Anyway, he was there. And a friend of mine, whom I had met at many meetings, an Englishman, was also interested in joining us. And so he joined us too. Mm-hmm. His name was Ronald Mason. He is now Sir Ronald Mason, still in England. Leroy, of course, was killed in a plane crash a few years after he joined us. It was a great pity because he probably would be president now if he had stayed. He was interested in politics, and he was sufficiently charismatic as an individual. Mm-hmm. That he almost got the elected as to Senate from Michigan, he didn't make it. But then he decided to run again, and it was in his flying from place to place that he had an aerial accident and was killed.
He piloted his own plane?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Something I highly recommend people don't do. I have lost too many friends with accidents from that. Anyway, so...
What year was that offer?
Now, we're now talking about the... we joined here in 1961. And I think he was killed in 1965. Uh-huh. Okay. Now, all of this, of course, was due to John Hanna. And the reason why we took the offer from Michigan State rather than any of the other four major universities was because of John Hanna. And he made a very simple statement. You do what you want to do. There are no restrictions on you. Set up any system you want. You're totally free. Well, that's a statement you rarely ever get from somebody.
From university president.
Yeah. And so what we did was we chose to be a graduate department only, so we wouldn't have any undergraduate teaching. We wanted to do mainly research. This was the dominant thing. And biophysics was just beginning, and therefore research was the most important aspect of it. So John Hanna's freedom that he offered us was the deciding factor in our coming here. Mm-hmm.
it sounded in some respects similar to the cyclotron experience, where he went out and actively recruited and brought Dr. Blosser here. And
yeah.
That sort of thing.
That's right. And it was about the same time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was in the, I would guess, late 50s, early 60s that MSU began to blossom from a cow college into a reasonably competent university.
How would you describe, did you have reaction from friends who said you're going to Michigan State?
Yeah.
What did they tell you?
Most of them thought it was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell do you want to go to Michigan State for?
Mm-hmm.
We did not have a reputation at the time. But I was young and I thought we had time, maybe we could build a reputation there.
Mm-hmm.
The other places had such overpowering, powerful individuals already established that we would probably have been swamped had we gone to those places and never gotten the freedom and capability that we had to do the work we wanted. So all in all, I think it was an excellent offer, and we have not seriously regretted that offer at that time, and not for many years. They gave us complete freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that complete freedom that allowed me to do the experiments that led to the discovery of the cisplatin drug and the anti-cancer activity.
Mm-hmm.
Had I not had that freedom, I never would have done it.
Mm-hmm. What was there? In those early, what was the focus in your early years here, after you set up the program?
Okay. Well, remember, I was a physicist,
mm-hmm.
But I had been working with light and crystals. So this was the interaction between light and matter that was fascinating to me. Now, in a biological system, there are two areas where this plays a role. One is in photosynthesis, but Melvin Calvin at Berkeley was already in that area. And successfully so, he won a Nobel Prize for it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was in vision. And so I chose to go into the area of vision. How does a photon of light entering into the eye and being absorbed trigger off a neurologic reaction in the brain that tells you you've seen something?
Mm-hmm.
This was the problem we attacked. There were a number of other problems that we were involved in, and we published about a third of our papers were on that subject. About a third of our papers were on the properties of proteins and their ability to conduct electricity, which is important for their function in the biologic system. So that took about a third of our work. And then, of course, we hit upon this accidental discovery of that finally led eventually to cisplatin. That's about another third. About a third. I'd like to cut them all down one quarter because there's a fourth area that we are now were in for a long time, and that was aging.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to go into that. And you can see that what this freedom allowed us. When I was 40, I suddenly became aware at the birthday party my wife threw us, threw me, that I was 40, and a good part of the conversation of the faculty members who were friends of mine at the party was on the fact that 40 is a dangerous age for men scientists. It's the time when they sort of have the equivalent of a female, what do they call?
The menopause?
The menopause, right. And so they start to become worried and they do all sorts of foolish things. It's when a professor divorces his wife and marries his graduate student.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want this to happen to me. I was happily married with two lovely children. Mm-hmm. So I said, look, aging is something that we're all intrigued by and worried about. So let's go into it and see what the hell it is. So we went into aging. And so all I had to do was, you know, apply to the government, get funds, et cetera. I had a laboratory. Mm-hmm. And poof, off we went. The universities had no say in the matter at all.
Were those grants easy to get at that time?
Yes.
Okay. Because yeah. They're
biophysics at that time was a hot topic in the government support.
Were there any other institutions that were involved in aging research significantly, or was the MSU project one of the earlier ones?
Well, I think we were one of the earlier ones. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There have been individuals working on various aspects of aging, mm-hmm. but nothing from the point of view of a biophysical process. Mm-hmm. So we were among the first in that area.
So the in dealing with Dr. Hanna after the initial recruitment, was he supportive of you as time progressed in the later 60s?
More important than that, he ignored us.
Oh,
he when he said, you do what you want, he meant it. He wasn't going to stick his nose into our work. Mm-hmm. He was happy at the successes we had, mm-hmm. and he congratulated us, and we had a wonderful relationship with him. Mm-hmm. But he never told us or what to do or even got into details as to what we were doing.
Mm-hmm. How about the provost at that time? Jake Neville?
Or no, he was a reasonably supportive individual. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had grants, and mm-hmm. that was a success, and mm-hmm. He felt it was bringing something to the university. Then he was replaced by, who was the one after him? Was not...
You were involved with Mulder, probably.
With Melder, yes, uh-huh. very much so. Mm-hmm. We were at that time talking about the general idea of building a science complex, commercial, around the university to take mm-hmm. advantage of it. This was a topic that was just becoming interesting, mm-hmm. and a number of universities were moving in that direction. And Milt Mulder was the representative of the university in relationship to these other places to see what they were doing. And he was he wasn't a scientist, mind you, mm-hmm. so it didn't really matter, though. He was a good man. I mean, mm-hmm. he worked well with us. When did Cantlin come in?
Probably about 69, right after... I don't know if he was there for the transition between Hanna and Walter Adams, but he would have been... provost about that time, right?
Well, let's see. Walter Adams appointed him provost.
Okay.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to have to put a lock on my tongue with regard to John Cantlin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm sure in there's been a lot, you've written a lot about the 1968 discovery of the
anti-cancer
activity.
Yes.
And I'm sure every reporter asks you about that, mm-hmm. but what I'd like to do is for this institutional history, have you talk about maybe that eureka moment, if you had one. Or
okay. All right. When I was still at New York University and in the physics department, I was working on this idea of the vision aspects of things, and it was physical considerations that I was undertaking at the time. I then accepted the offer here and felt, well, if I'm coming here to a biophysics department, I've got to know some biophysics, and I've got to do something that's biophysical in my research laboratory. So what could I do? One idea occurred to me that intrigued me. If you look at the picture of a cell in the process of dividing, mm-hmm. you see a very specific pattern, almost like a football with lines coming out, etc. And to a physicist, this looked very, very much like what you would see if you took a bar magnet, put a piece of paper on it, and mm-hmm. sprinkled it with iron filings. Yeah. It's a dipole field.
Mm-hmm. The experiment I do in elementary school.
Yeah, nowadays. Right. And so when I first saw these pictures of a cell in division, and they reminded me so much of the dipole field, I thought, well, is it possible that the dipole field may be involved in the division process? This turned out to be not an original idea on my part. Mm-hmm. Someone else beat me to it. Mm-hmm. But he didn't do any experiments. I did. Mm-hmm. Okay? So what I wanted to do was to see, does an electric field have an effect upon a cell's growth? And we set up an apparatus, rather complicated, and I'd rather not go into the details of it here, mm-hmm. but to see whether we could affect the division rate of a cell by applying an electric field across a solution containing these cells, and just applying electric fields. And it turned out that there was a profound effect. As soon as you turned on the electric field, and of course we used platinum electrodes so that we could bring the field in, and platinum is known to be non-biologically active. It was mm-hmm. inert. As soon as we turned it on, the growth stopped, and we were in danger of washing out the all of the living cells. So this was an interesting thing. You don't often find things like that. So we began to look into what was going on. And the first thing we did was looked under a microscope at the cells. And what we saw was, if you walk downstairs, as you go out, you'll see a picture of what it looked like. Normally, the cells that we were using, in this case it was called E. coli, have the configuration of about my forefinger, the first digit. And that's what we expected to see. It grows by growing to twice the length, and then it pinches off in the middle and separates into two, doubling. So this is the way the stuff grows. Instead, what we saw was one that kept on growing, not dividing. Up to 200 times its normal length, 300 times its normal length. So, and when we turned off the field, all of them started to divide. So we had a process of control of the cell growth that was rather unique and nobody knew about before. And we decided to look into that because it had the possibility of doing something which we initially had in mind. Namely, if we could control the growth of a cell with an electric field, could we control some cells with a frequency of one sort and other cells with a frequency of another, and then we could attack a tumor by choosing a unique frequency and affecting only the tumor cells and not normal cells. So this was a means of treating a cancer. So we had that in our mind. And here we had an effect where turning on the cells, turning on the electric field, had a profound effect on the cells. And so we went after searching for the cause of the effect. Turned out after 2 years of searching that the effect was due to the fact that we were using a chemical called ammonium chloride the cells growing in the culture, and we had platinum electrodes in the culture, and some of the platinum is going into solution as a very specific chemical structure. which took us another 2 years to identify. And it had the effect of the chemical alone, without the electric fields. The electric field was just making the chemical from the platinum electrode. But once it was made, it was the chemical that had the effect on the bacteria.
So not the charge?
Not the charge, no. So we started to investigate the nature of that chemical effect on the cells. And it turned out, eventually, that it was blocking cell division. And we thought, well, if you block cell division, that's good for cancer. Let's try it. And we did.
When were there any others that were working with you at the time on this research?
Oh, yeah. I had...
Other chemists?
No, I had a group of people working on the other projects. We had about 10 people in the laboratory. And two of them were particularly involved in this particular research project with Mrs. Loretta Van Camp and Mr., now Dr., Tom Kriegis. And they worked with me on this particular project. And later on, we had many, many more. I mean, I must have had... some 50 different people working on the project, postdocs, visitors.